Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Looking for a gift for a coach who loves basketball coaching? Get them a membership to basketballimmersion.com so they can join thousands of coaches who are stimulating their coaching with a world-leading platform for basketball coach education. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sign-up to get them a gift during this special time of year.
Welcome to the podcast. So excited today, all the way from Australia, to have Adam Caporn with us, who is currently the head coach of the Basketball Australia Center of Excellence men's team and an assistant coach with the men's national team. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We were just talking, one degree of separation, know so many people that know you and speak so highly of what you do and, you know, all the good things that are happening. Great to have you. And maybe quickly just give us an overview of the Center of Excellence program for us.
Yeah, sounds good. And yeah, thanks to you, Chris, for all you're doing for coaches around the world and really enjoy your podcast. Basketball Australia Center of Excellence is a national academy with the mission of developing athletes to win a gold medal at World Cup or Olympic Games for Australia in basketball. It's quite a broad mission. It's been around since 81 with some changes in name and some strategies for a long period of time now. It's been pretty solid and consistent. So in terms of trying to achieve that goal, what's been discovered is where we can make the most impact is having 12 residential athletes between the ages of 16 to 19 to try and bridge the gap, to speed up their development and bridge the gap for between youth basketball and professional basketball, to give them some tools to coach themselves, to speed up their development and get them ready, but also send them on their way and be a platform of support going forward. So that's the general line, but there are no rules essentially. Like, we have had some older athletes, some guys come in younger. It's really individually tailored and built around individual development as its key objective, which is really liberating in many ways.
Right. It must be great to have that flexibility as a coach and certainly with a bigger focus than just winning games, and that's on the development of a player.
Absolutely. Competition is a key part of development and the adversity of competition and being a winning player and all those things. But, you know, one of the great challenges in development is the weekends, the outcome of the game on the upcoming weekend being a distraction from developing young people the very best you can. And we work hard to reduce that. Well, we really don't have it as part of our job description. So it is liberating. It really makes you think and invest a lot of time. And it's very time intensive because each individual requires, you know, your utmost attention. But yeah, we found it quite a successful strategy.
And if I'm correct, you play in the second division, the second level of professional basketball in Australia. So you do play competitive games and within your schedule as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we play in the weekend and we'll travel for games. It's a very tough competition, Division II, semi-professional import, American imported players, professionals from our first league. And we will travel for those games. We'll have home games and we'll treat those as sort of the exam or the assessment and part of our ongoing development, of course. But the competition is an important part. It's not all always equal minutes on those sorts of things. We use that competition to facilitate change because it's a very difficult competition for young people against men. Ultimately, there'll be some failure in that, and that feedback's essential as a conduit for change and just overcoming the challenge of it. We play in that on the weekends, and we'll play in a third division during the week as well. And some players will play in one and the other and develop, and depending on their level at that time.
Well, it's great. And what's also unique, obviously, is the NBA Global Academy being there as well. And can you talk about that, the impact of having that academy there and the synergy back and forth between the two groups?
Yeah, it's been a really fantastic thing for Australian basketball, for our program, and hopefully for the NBA. It's a very close partnership. Basics of it are that their academy system is built upon our IP, our intellectual property and our system. It's got its own nuances and things like that, of course, and expertise. But their global academy is situated in Canberra, in the same offices, in the same facility as our Centre of Excellence. We help initially manage and set up the program, and now it's got its own staff and it's self-perpetuating, so to speak. But we work very closely together every day, and we've intertwined our competition calendars and have a really unique, diverse, challenging daily training environment. It's been really beneficial. So what we get out of it is a better daily training environment, some great basketball relationships and access to more information and innovation and things like that, and a few extra Australian scholarships in the Global Academy. And the NBA gets to use our model and IP.
That's great. And I know one of the things that is very important and dear to your heart is shooting. So let's get into that a little bit so we can get into some of the things that you actually do within the program. So can you talk about the value of shooting within the program?
Well, I think it's the master skill. It's the most important skill in basketball. That's obviously as for our players to be successful, and especially in the modern game with the the evolution of spacing and the three-point line and advanced statistics, that space is just growing and growing. And yeah, so we put a lot of time into it. I have three things that we say we're going to do in every session, and that's shooting, play one-on-one, and play some scrimmage every time. And we have a target of up to somewhere in the 25 to 30% range of all our practice time is spent shooting. And yeah, really enjoy going through that process with young people. It's quite unique because I think it brings a blend of strategies that the coach requires, including psychology, of course, because there's a lot of inbuilt anxieties and history into shooting development and teaching.
Well, you talk about that with mindfulness and clear your mind and removing anxiety. Can you talk about actually how you approach that with, you know, the practical steps that you use to be able to develop that within your athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. So the shooting plan we deliver the players when they first come in is a simple explanation. Three steps. First part of the plan will be to clear your mind. Sounds really simple. It'll be an ongoing thing. Obviously, everyone wants to make shots, but you can't be at the whim of the outcome of the ball, of that shot. You have to believe in the process, not the outcome. And that helps you get on a path to becoming a mature athlete. It also, the nature of shooting and the journey for a lot of young people is you've had a lot of coaches and you've heard sometimes conflicting ideas and you're assessing every little part of your shot. And we know that shooting's an unconscious act. So if your mind is over-involved, you don't have much hope for success. So clearing that mind and practicing that is a big part of the first step. And then talk about enjoying shooting, but that's part one, clear your mind. Part two is we're going to develop a simple plan, a simple technique plan, and we're going to execute a lot of repetition, a lot of contested repetition and open drills, and seek your inclusion in the feedback and hopefully develop a really introspective athlete. And then part three is to enjoy shooting. So that really is the third part, is around the athlete's motivation to like come into the gym and get in and get extra reps and find a way to play shooting games with their friends and leave the space in our program for the athletes to drive some of their own work and be accountable to that.
Well, it really, again, it paints the picture of how important the mind is, since the mind in this example bookends both sides of technique with mindfulness and then enjoy the shooting, and in the middle, the simple plan and repetition. So can you talk about, like, what are you guys doing for mindfulness? Is there meditation, visualization? What are some things that you guys are doing?
So a little bit of both. We have access to great facilities at the Australian Institute of Sport where we're based and have a really integrated sports science department, the resources that most programs would dream of, including professional programs. So have a massive advantage there. And it's great as a coach because you get feedback from skill acquisition experts and sports psychologists and things like that. Our basic approach is we have a well-being psychologist on site that starts the process with the players, and we have a sports psychologist as well. We'll talk about mindfulness and deliver a bit of a workshop as to what mindfulness and visualization are, just to educate the athlete and hopefully get some buy-in and some understanding of what the purpose is. And then we will have two, is the objective. Don't always achieve that. facilitated mindfulness or visualization sessions per week. We'll give players apps on their phone, encourage them to pursue it in their own time, and sometimes in our individual meetings, encourage a little bit more if they're struggling with something, or we see it as a way forward for that athlete. And try and get rid of any of the, or just debunk any myths or weirdness about it, and talk about it as a simple part of your training plan, that mindfulness is basically your ability to harness your attention. You would train a bicep by doing curls for your bicep. You can train your mind by bringing your attention back to the present over and over, and get better at that ability. And they start to recognize when they're distracted and when they're at the whim of their emotions and things like that. And we deliver some evidence, some scientific research. Visualization is real practice, that a combination of visualization and physical action is the best way for you to do it. Acquire the maximum amount of skill. And we'll deliver that. We'll have some of it facilitated. Sometimes coaches will lead it, we'll get involved in it, and we'll tailor some of it in greater amounts and lead up to competition, you know, with our periodization plan.
Well, I love it. And it should be obviously a part of everyone's development plan, especially when we're talking about this level of athlete that we're dealing with. But can you talk, like, how are you connecting it from theory, from the classroom, from the lecture to on the court? What are some things that are happening that are connecting those for players that they're applying the things that you're teaching them off court?
Yeah, great question. I don't have a great simple answer for that, other than I think we work hard to and remind ourselves, remind each other within our staff that conversations with players and asking questions are really important, obviously. And often in those moments, and observing what you might sense as a learning opportunity for a player, and frustration, or even moments of real, you know, success, I guess, or growth, that you have some casual conversations, and there's some real power in those. And in those conversations, draw some links to some of the work we might do in the classroom. Our classroom happens to be courtside. Like I said, we have great facilities. So we're just constantly trying to draw that link and to do it in observing other sports and find examples that, you know, we might see an NBA player sitting on the bench, clearly executing some sort of breathing technique, and bring it to our players' attention. And sometimes even bring mindfulness to the floor. We do, most of our work is reasonably traditional basketball work, but we'll do some mindful shooting where we'll ask for silence, or they'll practice a shot without a ball as the first rep, and the next rep will be with the ball, and then on we'll go with the rest of the drill. And to focus their attention on a certain part of their shot or their breath, and feel their breath, count those things, and practice attention. So different ways, conversation, and bringing some of it to the floor, I guess, are the basic parts of that.
Very cool. Very cool. And you talked about some competitive shooting and, you know, competition being a big part of the mindset of the development of a player. So what are some things competitively you're doing within shooting? Is it contested shooting? Is it tracking shooting, shooting the score? What are some things competitively?
Yeah, talk about this a lot. Obviously, every basketball coach, I think, is interested in shooting. I hope this doesn't sound too arrogant. We try and do everything. We have the capacity to here. We have great access to our players and a good amount of time and resources. So we try and do technique work, often repetition, build to dynamic movements, build to plenty of contested work psychology, and have a really good system of evaluation and feedback. I do think that the contested part and our training model of reducing and avoiding closed, blocked repetition to a degree, and getting it open and get the athlete involved in understanding the intrinsic feedback in contested drills and stuff like that. But ultimately, some of it's just design. So we will design drills and use coaches. And we see more and more of this nowadays, where we'll like simply be contesting shots, and we'll just give the offense great advantage and have fun shooting games where they'll be under closeout consistently all the time. And that will help develop some feedback, and we'll use questioning techniques to talk about footwork and the speed of your shot, because ultimately athletes want success. So in uncontested drills, we know that you can slow it down and we can demand game speed and things like that. But those contested drills really provide a good avenue for feedback, because there'll be some failure in it. And that's one of the most powerful forms of feedback and the intrinsic nature of it. So we have we have a sort of a build-up system of and big selection of drills. We like to keep it dynamic and changing and have the athletes involved and autonomous in some of it. So they'll select their drills. They'll be involved in selecting. We might start a shooting session with 6 minutes of technique work, and they will have 3 to 4 drills that they've been involved with us selecting to work their technique. And same with the contested drills. What do you need to work on? Shot release speed. Okay, so we've got 3 or 4 guys in that group. Here's a few drills we like. Which one do you guys want to do today? We'll hit that. We'll give them one we think they need, and we'll help, you know, be involved in some of the standards in the environment, of course. But we do a lot of contested shooting. It can be physically challenging for the athletes and sometimes the coaches, unfortunately, but I think it's really important.
Given the, obviously the ideal conditions in which you're training a player, and you've already mentioned it, I mean, from technology to access to all these different things, of all those things, what do you think other coaches should be doing more of, having tried so much of this under ideal conditions and thinking about less than ideal conditions, which I know you've also coached under? What are some of the things that you would go back and say, okay, I should have been doing more of this now after I've tested all these different things?
Yeah, very good question. I think that contested drills with thoughtful constraints as that will enable the athletes to have success, but be contested and get some intrinsic learning. I think that is the space that I would do more of and can be done in non-ideal circumstances. So a 3-on-2 shooting drill that requires quick decision passing, catch and shot, something like that, where the drill doesn't look perfect. And sometimes that can be an interesting thing for coaches to be okay with. You know, we get self-conscious about how things might look and it's not a perfect blocked random setup. But I would encourage and certainly self-reflect on doing more of that, where there's more meaningful repetitions for athletes. And I think they can be done in less than ideal conditions. And the constraints can just be changed to let the athletes have a good level of success, but to get meaningful feedback. The other thing, and this is something I skipped in the last question, I went on for a bit too long, apologies, but I think the evaluation part is key. Athletes want to always get their highest score and things like that. I think keeping data or anything that you can help demonstrate progression and reinforce messages and belief in what we're doing is really important. So we do some blocked random drills. We do them once a week. We do them in about 200 shots. Lots of programs do it, I believe. And we collect the data every week. It's the same time, it's the same conditions, same basket. And we will tally that over time. And we'll not have the athletes try and beat their best score. We'll do some fun games like that. But just show them that they're trying to beat their average, that to have a long-term approach to shooting, that one more make in 10 is meaningful, and that that's not going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen over the course of time. And we're beating our average and help them understand that they're having success, that things are working, and that becomes like the self-perpetuating feedback loop, I think can be useful and can be also done in less than ideal situations, just counting scores and collating that data.
That's awesome. I mean, I love that approach. It's a long-term approach, and one more make is progress. I mean, it's so true, those things that sometimes we neglect to notice as coaches as progress. And because we focus too much on perfection as coaches.
And failure is progress if, you know, the sounds cheesy, but the learning from it is important, that your improvement and development is not going to be a perfect line. It's not going to be linear. It's going to be jagged. And, you know, mindfulness plays a part, in my opinion, on reducing those downs and up and keeping it more consistent. I think all of that's important stuff.
Well, and you're talking to and this may be a good segue, you're talking to a big believer in nonlinear pedagogy in that sense as well. So I'm wondering, because I think I've asked a number of coaches this recently about this perfect season plan or this perfect weekly plan, but especially in these conditions, I mean, your athletes are specialists in the sense that each one is unique and different. So do you guys practice nonlinear pedagogy in the sense that, you know, you're not coming in and saying at this point in the season, you have to be able to do this, this, and this? It's different for all of them because they're different ages, different levels, but it's just different for everyone. Anyways.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, it's a difficult thing as a coach because you have your own expertise and experiences, I mean to say, and expectations is the word I meant to use. And sometimes the athletes aren't necessarily meeting those, or their development is not necessarily going to be as you hope or expect for a variety of reasons. One of which in developing athletes is physical, they're growing and testing their peak height velocity and things like that. So anyway, my point being that I think we certainly have to be adaptable and constantly having good discussion about our periodization, our plan and our expectation of the development, and adjusting elements for where they're at physically, where the competition calendar is, that we're going to have to adapt to the individual. It's what makes it really, really fun, in my opinion. This program is the handcuffs are off, but if you don't dig in onto the individual and connect with him and make him feel autonomous and adapt the plan to suit, you know, his learning curve is relative to him. I don't think we're maximizing our opportunity.
So coming back full circle then, you mentioned this already, but athlete-centric. So you're letting athletes be involved actively in this process of their development. Can you talk about some of those ways? You mentioned other already, they can self-select some drills or different things like that, but can you talk about some of the other ways that you're doing that?
Yeah. And we certainly believe in a holistic athlete-centric approach. We talk about that all the time. And quiz the players and ask them what is the most important thing in the program. And the answer I expect to hear from them is that they will leave you with the ability to coach themselves. And I guess, you know, the fancy word I like to use amongst our staff is self-efficacy, that the athlete is not reliant upon us, that they have to leave us and we have to be egoless and they have to have great confidence in their ability to control their behavior and develop themselves and continue the journey they're on. So we'll try and involve them in and educate them in all parts of the plan and why we're doing certain things. And it can be, doesn't mean that we don't bring a level of standard and elite expectation to the program, but they certainly need to be educated. And ways that we'll involve them in that is as they have some experience and some repetition and some feedback, get them to come to us with some ideas of how they might improve a certain area of their game. We ask them to execute one 20-minute workout with any coach of their choice on any, but to come with us to organize the time and come with an idea of something they want to work on. We will manipulate the constraints of those things and facilitate and encourage some things that we think will be mostly beneficial. But, you know, there's so many powerful parts to an athlete-centric approach, including motivation. Individual development is hard. We have a periodized plan, we have competition, but some of it is just hard. It's monotonous. And we usually find in May, we start in January. In May, we start to become a bit of a slog. So them understanding why they're doing things, that their motivation becomes more and more intrinsic and understood and autonomous, gives them the ability to drive through some of those difficult times, that they're not robots, and that ultimately, not only can they leave and coach themselves, but they can become the very best version of themselves. I think that's incredibly motivating for them and gets great buy-in for us.
It was such a great point. It's got to be hard because most players are building in an off-season towards a season, and your players are building towards a future in the sense that you want to win your games. And you guys have had great success with this team from what I've read. So it's not like you're not winning, but the bigger focus is obviously on the future.
That's right. And athletes want success now. It's they're passionate and motivated, and we have highly competitive young people, and we want to facilitate that. And certainly part of our development is teaching them how to be a winning basketball player. You know, we have our sort of culture and things we think help makes that happen. And we talk about head, heart, and hustle is sort of our mantra, smart, tough, and being a great teammate. And we want to harness those things, and we periodize the plan, but you're right, it is really hard. So we do have a season, it's in the first 6 months of the year, and then in the second half of the year we will vary the amounts of full court running we will do and things like that to give their bodies a chance to put on weight and adjust physically and adjust for growth spurts and things like that. But ultimately, all of it has to be involved with their involvement, with their understanding that this is going to have a really positive outcome, because there's always something sexier around the corner. They can go somewhere else and have people tell them how good they are. They can go to a lower level and really dominate and get more flash and attention. We try and put them in a bit of a bubble and get to work. And that brings challenges with it. But if we do our job well and get great buy-in and involvement for them, we think the benefits will outweigh the disadvantages of that.
Well, that's absolutely the goal, I know. So, and one of the other ways athlete-centric, I guess, evolves is you've talked about evaluation and self-evaluation, I assume, is a part of that.
Yes. So, you know, self-evaluation and learning styles, we would work to find how each athlete learns and what method of evaluation works for them. And they find, and we'll do a little bit of everything. But one of the reasons I think of learning styles is we do have a written diary. And after each session, the athletes will do some quick self-evaluation, often of process. They will want to do outcome, shoot better, but we'll try and keep them to process and simple rating system, consistent evaluation of their effort and application and behavior, not an expectation that they're perfect, but that they are mindful of it and trying to get better. Our evaluation of outcomes is a really interesting thing in development, because it can be an inhibitor. And shot making is the obvious one, resisting a change in technique because you want a better outcome right now and resisting the long-term approach. So evaluation needs to be thoughtful. I think that in development, it can be even more difficult, but ultimately competition feedback. So we use a lot of video, some statistics, and the athletes have involvement in the video. We have a really good system set up, but they can watch their own shots and gather their own data and bring it to a coach and discuss. We certainly do the bulk of that work and take it to them and involve them in the discussion. But self-evaluation, peer evaluation, we think is really powerful. Ultimately, one of the things that we can't forget in an individually tailored program is that being a great teammate is part of being a winning basketball player. So having your peers communicate with you and tell you how your behaviors make them feel and how it impacts them, I think is another really important part of the evaluation process.
Well, it's very cool stuff. I'm so happy people are hearing this, because I think we have a really small, sometimes, picture of what player development is, in the sense that you go do your workout and then you're done. And there's obviously more to that. We've talked about kind of post a little bit in terms of that, but what are you doing pre and post in terms of physical? Physical, I mean, warm up, cool down, what type of things are happening for the athlete that maybe coaches haven't thought about that are a part of what you guys do?
Well, we're really fortunate to have great resources. So I have a lot of people, experts that do a lot of that work for us. But we try to integrate our program in many ways with our staff and have our basketball staff integrate with the strength and conditioning and sports science departments closely. And I really enjoy that work. And I think it's one of the things Australia does really well across the board. But pre-practice, we do a lot of prehab, rehab work designed and led by experts, but we will be involved in discussions as basketball coaches, and we'll try and bring our expertise of basketball mechanics and movement and some ideas for individuals and what they might be struggling with to our eye in a basketball setting, to our strength and conditioning coach, our, you know, biomechanists and physios, and design sort of a basic weekly program for a certain time of the year, and then some more individual things. But in short, I would say we do 3 strength and conditioning sessions a week, and that takes care of a large chunk of their work. But before every session, we will do between and 20 minutes of work that is a dynamic warm-up, involves basketball movements, individual defensive attention, often stopping, landing, pivoting movements, and sort of integrate that as we build up into practice. So it feels applicable to the athletes. It's not just running lines and taking direction from a strength and conditioning coach. It's deeper than that. And then post-practice, the diaries that we spoke of, so they do some evaluation, and we have really good recovery resources. So they will have access to all the things that every athlete probably wishes they had, but hot cold tubs. And that's a really important part of the work we do as well, is we do some sessions where we talk about what you would do if you didn't have these resources, if you're traveling for competition, if you're not playing with a professional team that doesn't have the same thing or doesn't offer the same services. We'll have them come up with some ideas of recovery processes they can do without those things.
Really good stuff. Really good to hear all this happening. And one of the phrasings that I read from some clinic notes that I saw of yours is language to action matters. Can you talk about that? Because I love that phrasing.
I don't have a great recollection of where I said that, but I do like to use the word, as you, that I've mentioned a couple of times, that I believe in an integrated program, that we're all working together to a common goal. Sounds really simple, but that we're egoless, that we can have hard conversations with our athletes and get feedback from them and listen to them and as a staff across the board. So we will come up with like lots of programs, things we believe are important in our program culture that will help us be successful, that I want to be a great teammate. And what does that mean? And do those things. And that language we are going to repeat, we're going to talk to all the time, we're going to review, but ultimately it doesn't get reinforced unless there's meaningful action behind it. And we evaluate that action. And, you know, so much of best work I think we do is in coaching behavior. The skill work we do, I really believe in. The physical work we do, I really believe in. There's lots of people that can do that work really well. I think we have some great coaches here that coach behavior really well, not and help the athletes believe in behavioral change. And that's very painful and difficult. But, yeah. You know, lots of programs, and you talk about culture, it's a fancy word, and there's a lot of that going around, but that's just a phrase we like to use here. Language to action is, yeah, we've said we're going to do that, now we have to do it. And I think that's a big part of development, is taking responsibility and being accountable for your actions. So you say you're going to do something, you've got to do it. You're not going to be perfect, but you got to live up to it.
When you mention behavioral change, I love hearing that, and I love talking about that. And can you give us first, like, obviously no names or anything like that, give us a practical example of something that has, you know, been cued for you, this behavior needs to change, and then maybe the simple summary of the process that the player had to go through to change that behavior.
Most recent example I can think of, I don't know if it's the best one, but what we have in our program is great alumni and history and tradition. And we've had a journey with a player recently who came with great intention, made great sacrifice to be here like a lot of the athletes, but ultimately just living to the challenging standards. And it's elite, right? It's not normal. So for a young person, there's a lot of sacrifice and it's very difficult. And so for a long period of time, behavior would slip across the year, their behavior would slip occasionally, and it was just reasonably consistent. And the main conduit for change was the involvement of an alumni, like taking their own initiative, a really successful player we have in the NBA. I'd like to keep it private between them, but taking initiative and using our network, that someone that's been through something similar can share their own journey and give that feedback back to someone, that it's all going to be worth it. And that's, you know, I think that's a big part of leadership, and transformational leadership in particular, is that consistent intellectual stimulation of why are we doing this, and what is my motivation, and why would I change behavior? Because it is painful, it is very difficult, and brings consistent sacrifice with it. So that's something I think of, one, because it happened recently, and two, it's just a bit outside the box and not something that we initiated, but something I think of more is using our alumni group and external people, I guess, to bring some expertise and share some of their experiences. So the athletes feel connected, that they feel that they're not alone, and people get it and people are in it with them. Do the best we can with that, but we're not always the best people for the job.
So how do you bring this all together then? Because ultimately you do play games and you want to simulate practice and develop players within 5-on-5 setting and all that, because ultimately that's going to be how they're evaluated moving forward as well. So how do you come up with style of play with this focus of individual player development? How do you come up with style of play?
Well, we are influenced largely by the senior national team, and Andre Lemanis has set a great and the coaches before him and the coaches to come, a great style for us to follow and share that with the greater Australian network. And there's a great culture of sharing and coaching in Australia. So we take the lead from that program. And so it's built around how we can be successful as a nation on the international stage. And we will also tailor it with things that we think are happening in the modern game, so to speak, not bowing to trends, so to speak, but being mindful of what these athletes will need to be a commodity, a valuable commodity on a professional level so they can have successful careers. So style play is built around those two things. They will be educated in basic analytics and things that we think coaches and general managers and team selectors of national teams are looking for. So they'll be educated in that. But yeah, the style of play is really built around that, Australia's sort of national style of play, I guess.
So are you running flow then, a European ball screen? And then like within that, again, say you have unique players, you have a unicorn or you have a particularly good, you know, shooting big or different things like that. Are you adapting it to be able to feature the players, or are you trying to develop weaknesses throughout the year as well within what you do offensively or defensively?
Right. So I think a little bit of a misnomer that flow is part of our style of play, even though it's fairly consistent with teams and Australian teams in particular, but teams throughout Australia have been running that system that Andre has used himself. I was involved with Andre in integrating his and our national style of play through our network, but flow wasn't so much part of it. It was more about trying to be a more thoughtful and progressive offensive nation. And Andre's was built around the idea of having great rim attack and from there making good decisions in the keyway and using ball movement and player movement and making good decisions. And that's very vague and it was more detailed than that. But ultimately, that was what would be directed and talked about within our network and style of play. What you did to help facilitate those aspects of the game, like ultimately a player's or team's ability to get the ball in the keyway and make good decisions, finish strong and make good decisions from there is a driving force in offense. So you don't have to run flow. We run some of it, but ultimately for the personnel we have at the time, and some of that will just be on their particular skill sets, how we balance positionally, because we don't pick for position, so to speak, do a little bit of that. We'll adjust what we will run. And we'll also take into account what's happening in Europe and in the NBA and put little bits and pieces so the players are educated in it. But our style of play is built much more around concepts about what is a player trying to achieve off a pick and roll? What's our overlying philosophy on it? And what are the decision-making processes of that? I think Andre in particular was a really thoughtful teacher of those parts of the game.
A tremendous teacher and tremendous influence, obviously, on a lot of basketball at a lot of levels. And I mean, so many people in Australia, so not just clearly Andre as well. But, you know, so saying that with, you mentioned that the focus coming from kind of top down in terms of that, but you have flexibility within what you do to be able to adapt and run what you want to run, right?
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, it's not set plays. It's you can run different actions. You can absolutely, you don't get dictated that you must run this offense, these set plays. We will certainly have discussion around, all right, well, we want to, our players need to be educated in transition and pick and roll and these major concepts and how to execute such things. And we want to have a reasonably simple system that gives the ability to make decisions and reads and not read robots. And understand ultimately what are we trying to get on offense, and that is the best shot possible every possession. The best shot's a free throw, and the next one's a layup. You can argue that one. And then the uncontested three. And how are we going to try and do that? Well, we're going to try and do it with pace, poise, and penetration was Andre's terminology. But you can certainly say, to, you know, and in our discussion with coaches and in the program here, when Andre come and watch how we're trying to achieve pace, how we're trying to teach poise and different forms of penetration. And we, at certain times, certainly haven't run flow. We run different set plays, or maybe we have four guards and we're going to change what we're doing a little bit. It will have some similar concepts, but yeah, you can definitely run different things. And the same is on the defensive side of the ball.
Obviously, with your NCAA college experience as well, you've only mentioned really the influence of the NBA in Europe and obviously the Australian pro and national level. So is the NCAA game and the NCAA likelihood that some of these players may go to the NCAA, does that factor into some of the development? Or, you know, having come from the NCAA game, do you find that that's not worthwhile to in any way tailor what you do towards the NCAA?
Well, for us, it's not an objective, if that makes sense.
Yes.
An athlete's path remains their decision. The objective for us is to win World Cup and Olympic gold medals, and put athletes in the NBA would be a sub-goal of that for sure, and high levels of Europe. See college basketball as part of that journey, as are professional opportunities. That is not neglecting the achievement of college basketball scholarship or the level of college basketball. I love college basketball, and I think there's a lot that can be gained from that experience for young people, but it's different for every athlete. We will certainly talk about and educate the athletes in what we think as a nation we are pretty good at and what we can learn from different experiences and need to get better at. And I think college basketball can teach our athletes a lot, especially about the fundamentals of the game and dealing with a different level of athletes and competitiveness. And some of it's a great cultural experience too that helps them grow. So it's not an outcome. And in the decision-making process for college or professional for athletes, we are here to help as much as they want. But ultimately, it's their decision. We do talk about it being potentially different for them if the objective is to play in Olympic Games, that college basketball is a development opportunity. And you need to be a great servant to the university and that team and put the team first, of course. But that's the lens through which you're coming to that decision-making process.
Tremendous answer. I know it's a tough question to ask, but having been to so many different places and seeing how basketball has developed around the world, it, you know, a lot of those players are not developed in a way that's helps them succeed necessarily in the NCAA game, which is a completely different game, as you know. So, and that's not a negative. That's just the reality of it, that, you know, the influences are different.
Yeah, like any, I mean, you have to put the team first, but like any experience, if you can take from it what you need and add strings to your bow, then it's going to be a worthwhile experience. And we've had athletes have great success doing it. But there's the same experiences in the professional world. I don't think there is one path is better than the other. I do think what's important is the athletes, that's part of their educational journey of evaluating coaches and programs and culture and making those decisions, and decisions have to be their own.
Absolutely. So the quality coaching staff, I mean, I certainly know some of the people on your coaching staff, and can you talk a little bit, how do you use this staff? I mean, tremendous people, tremendously keen people in terms of basketball minds, and then obviously going outside just the immediate staff, this access to the support staff, which is just tremendous, not to mention even the NBA Global Academy staff. So how do you manage all that? How do you come up with best practices when you have so much innovation and excitement around you?
Yeah, it's been a really great learning experience. One of the things I'm really thankful in having the opportunity to do this job, because it's quite unique. I couldn't imagine another... Well, there are no other junior programs in my experience that have access to these sorts of things. And the NBA has definitely taken it to a new level. I think one of the things, as we sort of delve into it and talk about what we do a little bit and who we have, is reminding ourselves what our core business is constantly and saying, well, we're going to have great workouts and practices and individual time with the athletes, because we can get caught up doing a lot of fancy stuff because we have a lot of toys and opportunities and resources and great coaches. But ultimately, I think we do a good job of doing that. We get people and we have people that love getting on the floor, that love spending time with the athletes, that put them first, willing to challenge them and willing to play the long game with them. That, I mean, without that, none of it will work. We have in our office across both programs, and both programs basically operate as one. We have different responsibilities at times. So there's 5 basketball coaches in our office, 2 full-time S&Cs, 2 full-time physiotherapists, doc, sports psych. Name, I mean, I'm going to forget people, but we have a big staff building the system of reporting through the week, and small meetings and big meetings has been a little bit of trial and error. But our culture around it, I think, has been really powerful in that we try and make sure everyone feels part of the team. They feel like any team, people have to feel connected and they have to have a level of autonomy. And we say we want to have world-class communication, which means people cannot be too sensitive, but they are willing to speak their mind in the appropriate meetings and times and share their knowledge. So we have a lot of like quick hit meetings where people are bringing things to the table and we're getting feedback and input across the board. And we have a periodized yearly plan in great detail, but it's adaptable. And if someone's bringing some evidence to suggest we need to make a change, whether that'll be hashed out pretty deliberately and change, we'll certainly be willing to make changes. Yeah, there's no easy answer as to how we do that. It is what I think Australian teams do well across many sports. And we've spent a lot of time going to Australian rules football teams, English Premier soccer teams, and things like that to see how they do it. And ultimately, I think that connectedness and autonomy of people within your team is really important, as long as they have in mind what our core business is, that, you know, developing young individual athletes on the floor and holistically is the key area, not that person's ego or some other motive.
Well, and again, for coaches that don't know the history, obviously goes back to the Australian Institute of Sport and just so much great development and so much innovation and really the model for the world in terms of development academies at that time. And it continues on today, no doubt, because this is still, I mean, you have a chance, and I guess that's got to be exciting for you, that you, with everyone involved, has a chance to build the best development basketball academy in the world. Because honestly, I don't think it's happening anywhere else this way. So,
we certainly believe in what we do, and we think there's, you know, the program's had so many great servants, and I wouldn't want to mention too many names, so I'll leave people out. But we have Marty Clark, who's come back to his previously head coach, come back as part of the Global Academy, and we still have Patrick Hunter around, who's president of the World Coaches Association and former head coach, who comes in the door now and then. There's such a great history and tradition. You feel a great responsibility to add your little bit to it and serve it well. You feel it to the program and you feel it to the players. They've put a lot of faith in us to serve them well, so to speak. And it's really rewarding when it goes well, and it's completely devastating when it's not going so well and we work really hard to get it going the right way. But we take great pride in it, that's for sure. We really believe in what we do in the individual player development space, and like to think there's some good examples out there that give good evidence to that.
Well, and there's a great point in and of itself that you still have highs and lows as a coach, right, in this type of model and this type of environment. Because I think a lot of coaches think that like this type of academy model might be like the perfect utopia, in a sense that you're more focused on development and, you know, winning isn't as important, but you still go through the ups and downs, and it's still a gut-wrenching experience as a coach, isn't it? Because you're so focused on, obviously, you know, the best interest of each player.
Absolutely. I mean, as a side note, we also, so this is our day job, so to speak, but most of the coaches have opportunities to coach on national team staffs and things like that. So we still get our healthy level of competition and outcome-focused competition, I guess, and that sort of coaching pressure. But you're right, there are definitely highs and lows. And, you know, we've invested a lot in the athletes and give a lot to them and are just searching for ways to maximize their development. And when it's not going so well, it's really challenging. I mean, you're laying in bed at night thinking about it and trying to adjust it for certain individuals and rack our brains and have discussion, and some things don't go so well, so we'll adjust. Particularly challenging at times, and enjoy that challenge. And I think if you didn't, it wouldn't be the right place to work, that's for sure. But like the athletes, it's also just challenging day to day. I mean, the single biggest factor will be the work we do each day. We talk about that a lot. How are you going to make the NBA? We're going to have a great practice today. And we have to remind ourselves that in development, that there's no, all right, we're a bit sore today. We can't do that. We have to work hard and smart, but ultimately we have to give our very best to these young athletes. Sounds cheesy, but it's the main thing.
No, that's awesome. And, you know, I mean, two incredibly valuable parts of you being on this podcast is obviously all the insights that you provided from a technical, tactical, and, you know, really psychosocial perspective from coaching, but also just educating people about what's happening at an academy like this. Because again, I think it's the next wave. It's the future of basketball development that can help raise the level of play even more. And I think people are always asking that, can the game get better? Is it going to keep going this way? And it's like, I mean, from your perspective, I assume you've got to believe it's going to get even better with more of this holistic approach to player development.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that the NBA is investing so much in this area gives us great excitement as coaches and people that love the sport that, you know, the NBA is, from anyone's perspective, is an incredible product and league and level, but they're invested in getting better. And that, I think, speaks volumes. Like you said, the idea of creating the perfect development program can be some sort of weird utopia fallacy. Like, I think it needs to be very difficult. You know, it needs to be a very difficult, challenging environment, and the competition and the expectations need to be hard, but it needs to be, that needs to be one part or piece of the pie. That the holistic approach is certainly the way to go. And the advances in well-being and even in skill acquisition clearly demonstrate that with any level of reading. Doesn't mean we can be soft or give way to the fact that adversity is a key part of what we're going to do. And yeah, I think holistic is the word, is a bit of everything and in different levels for each athlete. And yeah, I think the future is really exciting. And the NBA's investment in the space is really exciting.
Tremendous stuff. I can't thank you enough, Adam, for taking some time and being able to share with us. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Really appreciate you having me, Chris. Thanks a lot.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.